On Tech News Today, why the Amazon smartphone might be super cheap. Plus, Facebook wants to be your bank, and the Heartbleed flaw finally claims its first documented victims, Canadian taxpayers. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Monday, April 14th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used Apple and Android devices are worth at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day in conversation with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is Joe Panettiere, Joe's editorial director for The VAR Guy, MSP Mentor, and Talking Cloud. Welcome, Joe.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me back. It's good to see you.
Always great to have you on the show. I love your insights and your sensibility. You really have a great and keen insight into the industry, and I read your stuff regularly and enjoy every word.
Yeah, well, we enjoy being here. Thank you very much for having me back. I appreciate the time.
All right. Well, let's get into the news. Jason reported on Friday during Tech News Tonight that Amazon plans to release a smartphone this year. The phone is expected to have four cameras and eye-tracking technology that displays 3D images without goofy glasses. A piece published over the weekend by Roger Chang and Donna Tam says the killer feature of this phone won't be the unusual 3D, but the price. Roger Chang is the executive editor for CNET News and joins us now. Welcome, Roger.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into your observation about the price or your opinion about the price, can you first recap what we know and what we think we know about Amazon's first smartphone?
Yeah, sure. So as you said, the rumored phone is supposed to feature four front-facing cameras that have some sort of eye-tracking technology that will allow for the images on the screen to appear as if they're 3D. It's supposed to be announced in a few months, and then I believe it will launch in September. So there's not that much detail outside of that, but that's some news, some revelation on Amazon's plans.
Now, the casual observer might be forgiven for thinking that this is a high-end play, because this idea of having four front-facing cameras that enable a kind of 3D that's been described as hologram-like, it sounds right. Like they're really taking the high road on technology, and you would expect a higher-end price to go with that higher-end technology. So why do you think that a low price is really going to be the big feature here?
Well, the thing about it is 3D, I feel, is still a gimmick that has been tried before, actually, with a couple of phones, HTC and LG, notably. Those phones were pretty big failures. For Amazon, it doesn't have a brand that connotes premium. You don't think, oh, I'm going to pay up to buy an Amazon device. You pay down, right? The reputation has always been that devices offer good value. So Amazon, in order for Amazon to be successful, they really have to have a phone that's competitive on price. I mean, all the other, the gimmicks, the gadgets, the features, that's all really secondary to price for Amazon. I mean, it's not Apple. Like it doesn't command that kind of premium. So it definitely needs to compete on price.
Hey, Mike, could I jump in with a quick question here for Roger?
Please do.
One of my questions here has to do with not only 3D in terms of capturing the images, but potentially 3D gaming down the road. Do you think they'd be, they've already announced their set-top box, for instance, a lot of gaming talk around that. Do you think they're going to focus on a gaming opportunity here as well? I know my kids are glued to their smartphones playing games. But on the other hand, their iPhones are getting a little long in the tooth, so to speak.
Sure. And I think you're right. Amazon has invested a lot. They've purchased a couple of mobile game studios. I think they are looking to build out their portfolio or their library of games that will run on, say, the Kindle Fire TV, as well as presumably this rumored phone. And 3D imagery would help with that. But again, you're not necessarily buying Amazon devices for 3D gaming. I mean, it just goes back to my main premise. This is sort of a budget brand, so it needs to have a phone that meets that perception. I don't know that many people that would actually pay up to buy an Amazon phone.
Right. And one follow-up. Any clues what may be going on with the carriers here in terms of breaking us free of expensive cellular contracts every month?
Well, that's T-Mobile's whole shtick, right? I think that the carriers, the other carriers, AT&T and Verizon in particular, are still fairly comfortable with those contracts. It still is unclear whether or not what Amazon has to offer will break people out of those contracts, but there's definitely a clear trend towards creating phones that are geared for the non-contract crowd, right? The Moto G is a perfect example of that. It's $179 off contract, perfectly reasonable upfront or on a monthly basis. That's why I think that Amazon would have a better shot if they can create a premium a phone that seems like it's premium, but for that budget price. That's sort of the trick. And Amazon has shown a willingness in the past to sell their devices at cost or even, you know, at a slight loss, so they can, you know, increase Prime membership or sell additional products and services on top of that.
Now, you brought up the elephant in the living room, which is they're, you know, selling at a loss, and you're referring, of course, right, to the Kindle line. And there was a lot of press at some point about them losing as much as, I think, if I recall, $50 to $75 per device, losing that much. And, of course, they have also been, you know, analysts have also pointed out that they've lost money on e-books, where they'll actually purchase or negotiate a contract for a specific e-book for their price, which would be like $12 or $13 per book, and then they'll sell it at $9.99 per book. So they're willing to, they seem generally as a company to not only lose money on devices, but keep their profit margins very low. They're famous for having almost no profit margins because every bit of money that they get, they plow back into gaining customers and gaining eyeballs. So first of all, I never felt satisfied with the reports about them losing money, that this was ever fully confirmed. It was kind of speculative based on estimates about how much their, you know, the components cost and all that kind of thing. How confident do you think that, how confident are you that they in fact do that, that they actually lose money on hardware devices in the past?
It's a good question. I think that whether or not they actually lose money is irrelevant. I think they're probably breaking even. They might even lose a little bit of money. But again, it goes back to what Amazon's goals are. It's to drive Prime membership and to drive people into its services to basically stare at Amazon's storefront and buy things all day long. And that is still the ultimate goal. That's its main business. So, you know, whether or not they make a little bit of money, lose a little bit, or break even is, I feel, it's irrelevant to Amazon. It's more about driving traffic.
Now, it seems to me also that they love the concept of showrooming, which is where consumers go into a retail brick and mortar store, they see something they like, and then they stand there with their smartphone and buy it on Amazon, which is a rotten deal for the brick and mortar stores and a great deal for Amazon. Do you think, what are the chances that this phone will be essentially optimized for showrooming?
I think that's exactly it. I mean, that's, you made the point. It's anything that can ease the way to making a transaction. Right now, on Amazon, you still have to load up an Amazon app. You need to log in. You need to run a search for it. I mean, I assume whatever phone they come out with will be completely optimized to make buying products extremely easy. You snap a photo of a product, and boom, it pops up on your phone, and you can one-click purchase it away. And I think that's what Amazon's going for here.
All right, Roger. Well, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today. It's a really interesting story. We'll probably have you on again when we get more details about this phone and then when they ship it. So I appreciate you coming on.
Loved it.
All right, Roger. You can find Roger's work at CNET.com. And you can find him on Twitter at Roger W. Cheng. All right, in a second, I want to tell you about what's going on with Facebook, and it may surprise you what new business they're getting into. But first, I want to tell you about Gazelle. Gazelle is a company that will buy your used device so that you can have more money to buy your next device. I love Gazelle, and I've used them in the past. They tend to help me justify the purchases of things that I don't need, like my current Moto X, and I appreciate that. Basically, how you use Gazelle is you go to Gazelle's website. That's gazelle.com, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com, and you simply find the device in their database, tell them what condition it's in, and then they'll give you a price. They'll honor that price for up to 30 days, so you have some time to send it in. If you have your personal data on that device, they'll wipe it. You should probably erase it before you send it, but if you don't, or if you don't do a good job with it, they'll make sure that it's completely wiped so your personal information is secure. Gazelle's paid more than $100 million to more than 700,000 happy customers, and there's good reason for that. It's super, super easy to use. They send you a box with a prepaid sticker. You simply put your device in the box, you put the sticker on the box, and you put it in the mail, and off it goes, and they pay you. through a number of ways. They'll give you a check. They'll give you a PayPal transfer. Or the best method, in my opinion, is that if you get an Amazon gift card, they'll pay you 5% extra. So you can buy your Amazon smartphone with that extra money. And, you know, again, free shipping, fast processing, no hassles. This is a fantastic service. And if you've got gadgets lying around, if you're watching this show, you probably do have lots of gadgets around. Send them in, get more money, and fund your next purchase. So find out what your Apple or Android device is worth. Take a minute. Go to gazelle.com to find out, and do it now because your device may lose value the longer you wait. Well, Facebook wants to be your bank, according to an exclusive in the Financial Times this morning. The social network is trying to get approval from the Central Bank of Ireland to offer financial services in Europe that include bill paying. Hannah Kuchler is the San Francisco correspondent for the Financial Times, and she's one of the authors who broke this story and joins us today. Welcome, Hannah.
Good morning.
So what kind of services is Facebook looking to offer?
Well, we don't think Facebook's going to be a bank in the sense that it's going to suddenly start offering mortgages and credit cards or whatever. And in fact, to do that, they would have to obtain even more licenses than the licenses that they've got at the moment. But what they're looking for is to try and get remittances is probably the first stage, it seems. So remittances is when people are transferring money, often, you know, immigrants transferring money back home, and they want people to be able to do that over Facebook. Obviously that would really help them in developing markets as well, where they, they're continuing to grow.
Developing markets like Europe?
Well, my question. No, but you've got to have the people in. You've got to have the people earning the money in the West who are sending it back to developing markets. Right?
So UK banks and so on.
And so the e-money license that they're applying for in Ireland will help them, back up the European side. They actually already have payments and money transfer licenses here in the US, which they've been gathering sort of quietly for a couple of years. As I said, they don't have a full banking license. And the last time a non-banking corporation tried to get one here was Walmart about 10 years ago, and it went supremely badly. And I'm not sure if Facebook really want to get into that kind of political mess.
Hmm. Now, who's Facebook partnering with? I understand they're partnering with some money transfer, bill paying type companies.
So they've been in discussions with three London startups. One was called Azimo, another one. But there are three names. You can read the story. I'm not going to remember them off by heart. But they're very small, but they're doing interesting things already and sometimes interesting things on Facebook. London is becoming this kind of center for financial technology as it would be because it is such a financial center. So it's interesting to see that Facebook are trying to sort of sniff around some of these companies and see if they can buy them for themselves.
Hey, Mike, if I could jump in. Hey, Hannah, would you characterize these discussions as preliminary discussions with the three different companies, or do you think they're pretty far down the road with these discussions?
With the license, the e-money license in Ireland, they are, very close to getting it. That will be in the next few weeks. With these companies, I wouldn't say that they're about to sign because... for my information, they may have even they're still in discussions.
Okay, all right,
and
then
one. Sorry.
No problem. And then one follow up. Would you any guesses as to when the service may launch, or is it way too early to say?
It's pretty early. I mean, this is, Facebook's made a lot of unusual bets, right? In the last few weeks, we've seen them buying a drone maker, and we've seen them buying Oculus Rift, obviously, and things. So this isn't as far out as those things, because those things are like, real long-term bets on the future of the internet and the company. This is much more near-term, but I wouldn't say it was necessarily, we're all about to start using Facebook for sending money in the next couple of months.
Now, somebody might be curious about why Facebook would want to get into, third world, I guess, is the term we use in the United States. I know that's not popular globally. But in the third world, it wants to get into these bill-paying scenarios. But in fact, the biggest money transfer company in the world is based in Kenya, a company called Safaricom. Safaricom, I think
Hello?
It is. Yeah, can you hear me? Hopefully Hannah's still with us. Are you still with us, Hannah?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. All right. So they have something called M-Pesa, which powers the majority of money transfers in the world. And a lot of people don't realize this in the West, but Facebook actually heavily subsidizes the use of Facebook around the world in markets where people have to actually pay for, nickels and dimes to pay for their internet connectivity. And they essentially say, and Google does this too, by the way, where they'll pay for it as long as you're using Facebook, or in the case of Google. So it's a huge industry, actually, to have these little money transfer things around the world. Now, I guess the elephant in the living room to me is that, you know, who's going to trust Facebook with their money? I think a vast majority of users may barely even trust Facebook with their password. Do you think that Facebook has the kind of reputation and standing in the world to have people trust them with their financial transactions?
Well, yeah, that is an important question. I think, you know, Facebook, especially in the West, has been involved with a lot of sort of privacy battles, and there's a lot of mistrust and feeling that they might be sort of trying to secretly change their privacy policies and things. Although that's something that Facebook's very much trying to target. I mean, last week it released a whole load of new stuff about privacy, which was all trying to sort of clean up that reputation. In terms of trust in the developing world, I don't know. It's a big brand. Over a billion people are on it. You know, when your choice is between that and a major bank here in the US, then maybe you're not going to want to do it. But if your choice is between that and, yeah, a small money transfer business down the street, why not go with Facebook? It's got a reputation to uphold.
All right. Well, Hannah, thank you for coming on Tech News Today. I really, really liked your story. It was a killer piece, and I appreciate your exclusive.
Ah, you're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Thanks again. You can find Hannah at FT.com, of course, and on Twitter at Hannah H. Kuchler. Right, let me spell that for you. H-A-N-N-A-H. K-U-C-H-L-E-R. Well, Microsoft released Windows Phone 8.1 to developers today. It's been 18 months since the last major update. Chris Davies is the executive editor for Slash Gear, and he posted an extensive review on this this update, and he's here to tell us about it. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on again.
All right. Well, reviewers, including you, seem to really be impressed by this update. What is it that's good about Windows Phone 8.1?
I think the interesting thing about Windows Phone is that reviewers have liked it for a long time. We've just had a great deal of trouble actually recommending it for the mass market. It's been an OS that's had an awful lot of promise, but unless it hasn't necessarily ticked all of the boxes that, say, Android or iPhone have ticked. The nice thing about Windows Phone 8.1 is that some of those kind of outstanding boxes have been addressed. So, for instance, you have things like the new Action Center, which is basically Windows Phone's version of the drop-down notification bar that you see on Android and iOS. And that does things like it brings all of your alerts across various different applications to one single place. And it makes the whole OS feel a lot more suited to the kind of power users who are attracted to smartphones.
Now, Cortana, of course, which is the sort of Microsoft version of Siri or Google Now, demos really well. But do you think this is really going to be ready for prime time by the time this ships? What was your impression?
Microsoft's really clear that Cortana is still in beta at the moment. And from having used it over the past couple of weeks, it certainly is in beta. The idea is that you can talk to it using natural language, and it will not only give you answers for things like web results, but it will use a contextual engine and artificial intelligence to pick out important details. Like, for instance, if you've got an upcoming flight in your confirmation in your inbox, it will drag those details out and remind you if there's a flight delay or give you updates on that. It works sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't work. And often you can find, or I certainly found, that I've been talking to it for a while, and I could have actually done the task I wanted to do a lot quicker if I'd just done it the old-fashioned manual way.
Now, Cortana is for the US only initially. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a limited kind of availability, and perhaps with my British accent, that's one of the issues faced. Everyone else will just get the regular Bing search, though that has been updated for Windows Phone 8.1, so you do get some kind of extra features, but you don't get that two-way conversation that Cortana delivers.
Hmm. Now, you wrote this. Go ahead, Joe.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mike. Hey, Chris, quick question for you on the developer side. Yeah. And I know this is all new to market with 8.1, but are there any early clues in terms of whether or not developers are going to get behind this?
I think developers are quietly keen. Just like carriers, we've heard that they're looking for a kind of a third ecosystem to compete with Android and iOS. I think developers are also, you know, very intrigued about Windows Phone. I was at Microsoft's Build developer event a couple of weeks ago, and there's an awful lot of enthusiasm there, not only from existing Windows Phone developers and Windows developers, but, you know, people who are coming from the Android and the iOS ecosystems and wanted to kind of get a look and see some of what Microsoft is doing. And that doesn't necessarily have to initially mean developing an app for Windows Phone. It could be using Azure in the background and that, using that as a gateway drug, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. And then one follow-up. In terms of the applications that Microsoft may do some tighter integrations with, I think you've done some reporting on Skype, for instance. But what other, in addition to Skype, if you could talk about that a little bit, could you talk a little bit about Microsoft's other cloud applications and how Microsoft may continue to blur the line between its phone platform and its back-end cloud services?
Yeah, there's obviously fully baked OneDrive integration, and everyone gets 7 gigabytes of storage free when you sign up for an account on the device. We've also seen a lot of other kind of links between things like Xbox and Office. So Office 365, again, in the cloud, you can access the documents that you've created and stored there on your Windows Phone and even do things like edit full presentations, which is something that not a lot of mobile phones can do. And now Windows Phone 8.1 supports things like video out either over a USB connection or Miracast. So it means that you can hook up an external display and you could actually run an entire presentation from your phone if you wanted to. But it's still pretty early days for things like that. I think for consumers, the bigger interest might be the Xbox integration. And hopefully, as we see kind of Microsoft bringing together the different types of applications and building on that kind of common app platform for Windows Phone and eventually Xbox, I think we should see some really interesting things there.
Now, of course, this release is for developers. It's possible for non-developers to download and install it. This will void the warranty, and you can't roll back to the old version. You can find those instructions online. They're being posted all over the place this morning. Now, Chris, I asked you initially what you like about this release. What do you not like? And I'm not asking you about what the beta stuff that might be fixed, but what, when this thing ships, what is it about this that's going to be its biggest flaw, do you think?
I think in some ways, applications are always going to be Windows Phone's biggest flaw, whether that's the actual number of apps that are available out there or the perception around it. And I think Microsoft and companies like Nokia are going to need to do an awful lot more outreach to kind of convince people that, you know, the applications that they're used to using on Android and iOS are also there or have equivalents in the Microsoft Windows Phone store. I think that's going to be their biggest communication message, perhaps more than a functionality message. In terms of the actual OS itself, there are little kind of remaining flaws that kind of you as you're using it, you're thinking, well, you know, why did it do it this way? So, for instance, when you open up a new email from the new Action Center dropdown and then hit back, it takes you to the home screen rather than taking you to the inbox of the in your email accounts. And so it's little things like that which are slightly annoying when you spend time with it. But overall, this is actually a really, really good improvement on Windows Phone. And it's definitely more than just a .1 upgrade.
And it has to be said that little annoyances like that exist in iOS and Android as well. It's just unavoidable. Each one has their own annoyances, but they've all got them. Chris, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today and telling us about Windows Phone 8.1.
Thanks very much for having me, Mike. Really appreciate it.
You can find Chris on slashgear.com. You can also find the review we referenced on slashgear.com. You should reference it if you care at all about this release, because it's a very comprehensive and thorough review. And you can also find Chris on Twitter at @C_Davies. Well, Google's thinking about favoring encrypted websites in search results, according to a report in the Wall Street Journal. Now, Joe, this is a really interesting potential use of Google's incredible power to determine who the winners are and who the losers are on online search. Do you think this is a responsible thing for Google to do if they did in fact do this? Again, this is just talk at this point. They haven't actually announced anything. But if they did, if they actually favored sites that had encryption over sites that didn't have encryption, is that really their job as a search engine? Or shouldn't they just favor the information based on what the information is?
You know, Mike, I think you when you broached this topic, you actually introduced the key word. There's just or the key phrase. There's just talk about it at this point. And to have a conversation about this right now, I think a lot of heads are being lifted up. A lot of ears are perking up. And people are saying, well, wait a minute, what does this mean ultimately for my own business strategy? So I think it's a healthy dialogue. But on the other hand, boy, I can bet that thousands of media companies worldwide are, calling up their CIOs today saying, are we encrypted are we not? When can we be encrypted? And what does this potentially mean for us? So I think more than anything else, this is sort of a shot across the bow of everyone on the web to get the conversation going about encryption. But should Google really go and take this step right now? I think it's definitely premature. I would love to, you know, I haven't seen the data yet. I didn't have time to do a quick check ahead of the show, but I'd like to see a data report that shows what percentage of the web is encrypted right now, and then identify the areas where it's not and see who the left behinds would be.
And of course, the conversation on this is coming from Matt Cutts, who has been reported by the Wall Street Journal as saying this in a speech at a recent conference and also in private conversations. And as you say, this could be just a way to light a fire into the behinds of companies everywhere so they jump on the encryption bandwagon as soon as possible. If this does happen, it wouldn't happen anytime soon, according to the Wall Street Journal. And Danny Sullivan, who's the editor of Search Engine Watch and one of the leading experts on search engines and Google, says that he thinks they're not going to do it. So he thinks it's just talk. It's not going to end up as being a real thing. But it is an interesting question, and it sort of is central to the conversations we're all having about encryption and security and surveillance and all that kind of stuff. So it is an interesting thing we'll be watching. So you know, it's also interesting in light of the Heartbleed bug, security bug, which was a bug in the encryption standard, one of the encryption standards itself. And speaking of which, we finally have a documented victim of Heartbleed. The Canada Revenue Agency, which is the Canadian IRS, says that the social insurance numbers of about 900 Canadians were stolen because of the Heartbleed security bug. The agency discovered the breach while fixing the flaw. Now, if you've been following the story, you know that everybody's been saying, well, there are no documented cases of any actual theft or whatever. And here we have a documented case of 900, the personal information of 900 Canadians actually being stolen. And, you know, the Canadian Revenue Agency is being super responsible about this. They've fully documented everything that they know about it, as far as I know. And so I think this is a model for how to do it. Joe, what do you think? Is this are we going to hear a lot more of these kinds of cases where people are actually discovering actual theft of data?
You know, I don't know how many we'll hear, but you can bet that there's more cases out there. And the thing I'd go back to was the Target situation last year. Think of how long it took Target to document the issue they had, trace it back to the fact that their own security team had known about the problem for quite some time. And then think about how long it took for Target to actually part ways, to put it politely, with their CIO over that security issue. That was a massive issue covered everywhere. And Target was not, you know, instantly responding to it. So now if you think about all the private issues, all these companies that don't need to necessarily disclose that something's going on, I think it'll be months and months before we get the full story out.
Yeah, and I think there's no way we're going to get any information about the majority of these cases. I think the Canadian agency here had some processes in place that enabled them to monitor this kind of thing retroactively, but the vast majority of sites, as I understand it, I'm not a security expert, but as I understand, this is a flaw that enables hackers and state-sponsored hackers, whatever, to go in and steal data without any trace. So I think that if there has been widespread abuse of this flaw, we're never going to hear about it, and that's an unfortunate thing. Hopefully people will get scared and fix the flaw. There's a process that's been well documented. If you listen to Twit from Sunday, there's some great information from that show about what you should do as a user, as a company, as a website person who has a website. So it's an interesting story, and it's really heartening to see an agency like the Canadian Revenue Agency coming out and having full disclosure very quickly about what happened in their case. Well, Samsung's got an event scheduled for April 29th. The invitation that they sent out hints at something related to photography with a cryptic slogan that goes, quote, capture the moment. That's capture with a K. The invitation coincides with rampant rumors about a new Galaxy S5 Zoom smartphone, which rumor mongers are now saying will be called the Galaxy K Zoom. The rumors also say the new Zoom will be thinner, lighter, faster, etc., and offer a 20-megapixel camera. Love to see these smartphones that really emphasize photography. Joe, are you ever tempted by these, like, extreme camera smartphones?
I'm certainly tempted. I'm embarrassed to admit I'm still on an iPhone 4, and I'm actually making a move probably in the next 6 to 8 weeks. So I'm scouring the market. The thing that intrigues me about Samsung, to tell you the truth, is Samsung perhaps is best known as is making the device and then leaning on Android, correct? Very recently, I was over in New Jersey at Samsung's U.S. headquarters, and they were showing off all sorts of software for the retail market, for the healthcare market, for financial services, etc. So you think about where they're going in the consumer market with some of this photography stuff. I'm very intrigued. And then you connect the dots back to the business side, where Samsung is quite frankly creating a lot of vertical market applications that Apple is overlooked in the mobile world. I'm super excited by what they're up to.
Yeah, that's great. You know, you might want to consider gazelle.com to sell your iPhone 4 and move up to a new Samsung. Just a thought.
I heard that rumor. I heard that rumor.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is going after Twitter again. First, he blocked Twitter to stifle sharing of alleged evidence of corruption. Then a court ruled the block unconstitutional, but he kept the block in place throughout the election. And now it's unblocked in Turkey. But Erdogan is now going after Twitter for, of all things, tax evasion. I guess he figures that if it worked for Al Capone, it worked for Twitter. This guy is really, I'm just going to say it, this guy's a bonehead. He's bringing so much attention to
exactly.
You know, he's trying to cover up, you know, basically bad government by demonstrating that he is, you know, he's running a bad government.
Yeah, you know what it reminds me of is Kevin Bacon in Animal House screaming, "Nothing to see here, move along, move along." And meanwhile, everyone is stopping to take a look. So we'll see how long this story plays out.
It's unbelievable. And it just keeps he keeps bringing it back into the news. It's just really, really unbelievable. Well, you've seen atomic watches before, but not like this one. The cesium-133, which was invented by John Patterson's company, Bathurst, Hawaii, works just like any other atomic watch in that it keeps accurate time with a clock controlled by the oscillation between the nucleus of an atom and the surrounding electrons. The difference is that unlike other atomic watches, which connect via radio waves to a remote atomic clock, the cesium-133 has the atomic clock built inside the watch itself. A new Kickstarter to fund the development of the watch has already met its goal after only a few days. And according to the Kickstarter page, a single chip inside the watch contains a laser, a heater, a sealed cavity of cesium gas, a microwave filter, and a photodiode detector, whatever the heck that is. The site also claims that the watch is the world's most accurate wristwatch, losing only a single second every 10,000 years. And they're selling the prototypes for $6,000 each. They've got just a handful of those. And they're selling the final versions for about $10,000 each. This is guaranteed as a woman repeller. What do you think, Joe? Would you wear this thing? It's like a novel lashed to your wrist.
Well, you know, I think the good thing, on the one hand, it may repel women. On the other hand, I am married. So, you know, maybe I'll finally be on time for things if I were to wear this. And I wouldn't have to reset it. What was it? Every 10,000 years, it's off by a second. So that type of reliability in terms of me and timing would probably be welcomed by my wife. But, you know, I'll have to check the price tag on this.
It's really, really astonishing. I mean, the atomic clocks that used to exist would be the size of like a, you know, a Winnebago or something like that. I mean, this is astonishing that this has been brought down to the chip level. And it's just a freaky watch. And I would wear it. I would actually wear it around just for that reason alone, just because it's such a triumph of technology. Plus, it's really, really dorky. And I appreciate that. So, but $10,000, maybe not. If those of you watching want to send a gift to your favorite technology news guy. You know what I'm saying? All right, yeah. Joe, well, thank you for being our guest co-anchor today. It's always
great
to have you on.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Yeah, it's great to have you on as always. And tomorrow we'll be joined by Dan Lyons. But before we say goodbye to you, Joe, let us know where people can follow your work.
Just follow me right on Twitter at Joe Panettiere, and that Twitter handle actually will cover stories from the VAR guy, MSP Mentor, Talking Cloud, and other Penton Technology Group websites.
All right. Great to have you on as always.
Thank you, Mike. Take care.
All right. You can subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/TechNewsToday. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV. And we want to hear from you, so send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us a voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. Don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.